Are you intimidated by Shakespeare? Do you not get Shakespeare? Or do you get him, and even though you've gotten him, you don't care for him? Well, you are not alone, because today I'm talking to friend of the pod, Liz Allen, who has been on her own Shakespearean journey, a journey of trying to get and or understand Shakespeare. Liz, where are you on that journey?
Well, first, I don't really know what a Shakespearean journey is, but I think I'm on one.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 19th year, number 958, Connecting with Shakespeare. In the last year or so, my friend Liz Allen has asked me enough questions about what the deal is with Shakespeare to make me think other people might be interested in the answers. Liz is a fabulous performer and improviser who coached the fictional improv team in Mike Birbiglia's terrific film Don't Think Twice. So part of her frustration, I think, is the knowledge that she, because she's a theater person, she's supposed to have a greater knowledge of Shakespeare than she does. That's a frustration many of us have, so I'm delighted to share my conversation with Liz with you, and only apologize that this episode will be slightly longer than usual, and only because we were having so much fun as 'twere speaking the speech.
Where I am on the journey, Austin, and why I find this so fascinating is, I am definitely intimidated. Two, I feel like there's just a hole in my theatrical knowledge, which is Shakespeare. Three, tried to fill it, tried to understand it, can't really connect.
Yeah.
And yet, I connect to what you do. I connect to a show about Shakespeare that's improvised. I connect to Shakespeare information. I'm told I use Shakespeare language all the time. In fact, you've told me.
Well, you do. We all do. I mean, this is the thing. We all understand and say more Shakespeare than we think we do. Because he's just so, after 400 years, just so part of the culture and the vernacular. But somewhere along the way, You have missed the Shakespeare boat.
No, I really have. And, I absolutely have.
And yet it's a thing that bothers you because you're a theater person. I'm putting words in your mouth.
No, you're right.
Is it a thing that bothers you because you are a theater person?
It absolutely is a thing that bothers me. One, I'm a theater person.
Yeah.
Two, I like to be haughty at dinner parties. No, and I'll tell you where
Yes, the pedantry and pomposity goes way up the more Shakespeare
well,
you know.
Well, yeah, that's what I need help with that. Obviously not. Okay, this is exactly when my lack of knowledge began to bother me. I have a technical degree, as you know, so I didn't study theater.
Right.
I had a little bit of Shakespeare introduced to me in high school. Not much. So then I find improv. I pick up improv in the early 90s here in Chicago, and I realized that I don't have a high reference level outside of a very narrow technical sort of physical science kind of area. Uh-huh. So like when the Bronte sisters would come up in Shakespeare, I'm like, oh no, I don't know anything. I mean, would come up in improv, or when Shakespeare would come up in improv, yeah. I would sort of seize up and panic and think, I better not participate, because I hadn't learned that it doesn't matter that I don't know. But I missed out on a lot of satirical opportunities, I believe, along the way, just because Shakespeare is so essential to almost how actors think, and sometimes improvisers.
Yeah, no, I could see that. I mean, the other secret, I think, about Shakespeare is that we always say, here in the Shakespeare biz, we always say Shakespeare is for everyone,
okay.
Which I think frequently sounds more like a threat than a promise, with the implication being if you don't get him, there's something wrong with you. But Shakespeare is not for everyone, demonstrably. I don't like opera. I don't like baseball. I don't like video games. I mean, nothing is for everybody, and Shakespeare might not be for you. I suspect he would be for you if you read him or saw him in films or productions that blew you away.
Well, here's what I have to confess to you and all your listeners. I have read him, and I took a class even in Shakespeare. And that's what's so embarrassing to me, is that it doesn't seem to sink in, and I don't know if that's my resistance or I need more exposure. So I'm excited for today, because I have some questions that I think might change my view.
Okay. Yeah. Let's start with your questions. You interview me.
Okay. All right. Here we go.
I love it.
Buckle up, everybody. I guess my main question is, if you met Shakespeare when he was alive, do you believe he was a lovable human?
Wow. What an interesting first question. Do I believe Shakespeare was a lovable human? I have zero idea. I want to believe that he was. I want to believe.
I do too.
Because I believe he was a humanist. I believe that he wrote characters from all spectrums of the social classes, from the working mechanicals to royalty to nobility to men and women, to different races. I think he wrote about people as people. So I want to believe that. But you know, how many theater people do we know? Are they all lovable humans?
Right. But I've wondered over the years, especially getting to know you and what you do more, I've wondered if maybe I'm a little hesitant to get to know him intimately, Shakespeare. Maybe I don't want to be disappointed. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm sort of figuring this out as we go. Tell me, if you wouldn't mind, reduce your... what's your intrigue in Shakespeare to, like, five words? What's your intrigue? All these years, Shakespeare's kept you intrigued.
Great poetic, dramatic, theatrical language.
Well, I mean, I'm in.
I mean, the longer version of that is that for me, Shakespeare uses language in a musical way. It's like, I love musicales. And I did musicals in high school and college. Nobody's ever going to hire me to be in a musical.
Why?
Because I don't sing as well. I'm not a dancer. You know, okay. I sing fine. You know, but doing Shakespeare for me is a way to perform. It's like a musical instrument. You know, for me, I love playing with the language. I just love a turn of phrase, and Shakespeare had one or two great turns of phrase that we're still quoting. And from as a playwright, and I'm not the first person to say this, but almost anything I've ever wanted to write for the stage was already expressed or some aspect of it phrased 400 years ago. And in iambic pentameter.
That's fascinating. So the iambic pentameter is in itself this rhythmic musical delivery. So
yeah, which Ian McKellen calls the rhythm of the heart, because it's ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. That's true I am. To be or not to be, that is the question. But even in that most famous line of all Shakespeare's, an iambic line is 10 syllables. That line is 11 syllables. So Shakespeare broke his own rules. Anytime a professor or an acting teacher says there are rules to Shakespeare, they are lying. There are no rules.
Yeah.
There are tools, not rules, things you can think about, things that can help you or not. It's like any acting class you've ever taken where you go, oh, that works for me. That doesn't work for me.
Same with improv, same thing.
Right, okay.
Take what works. Yeah. So I'm already learning so much.
Good.
That is fascinating to me, because I was going to ask you why iambic pentameter, and already I think I'm starting to build my own construction why, but why iambic pentameter? Was it like the thing of the day? Was it popular?
My sense of it, and here's where I fall down in my own scholarship. I know Shakespeare pretty well, but I don't know many of his contemporaries. But I know that I've read enough of his contemporaries to know that his language feels more, even though it's poetic, a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is poetic, it feels more conversational. Mm. And I think that's what the iambic thing does, is that it is poetic and it's heightened. And I don't think people talked like this. I think he was writing poetic, heightened language for the heightened reality of the stage.
But
it sounds conversational.
Okay.
You know, when a good actor is doing it well. Another thing you were talking about, you've read it. Here's the thing I do when I'm reading Shakespeare. I have to read it out loud. I cannot read it silently. It makes no sense just with my eyeballs. I need to put it into my mouth. It has extraordinary mouth feel, if you want to sound haughty and pompous.
That helps a lot. Did Shakespeare have children?
He did, yeah. He had a daughter, Susanna, and twins, Judith and Hamnet. Not Hamlet, but Hamnet. And Hamnet died and that in like 1595, 96, something like that. And he was in London, and we don't know whether he made it back to the funeral. I suspect he did not. But I suspect the loss of that, the loss of his son and the being away from his children affected him a lot. Just judging by his later plays, when he was an older playwright in his gasp late 40s.
Yeah. How late when did Shakespeare die? How old?
He was 52. Yeah. 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 When Shakespeare was my age, he had been dead for 13 years.
Wow. And that, back then, that was like a long life.
Yeah, it was a long life. But many of his later plays are about an older man's regrets about the way he's treated his family.
You're drawing me in already. And it's filling in a lot of blanks. I don't really even understand Shakespeare's life trajectory in terms of the content of his work. How early did Shakespeare write? What was like his first? Was he like Mozart? Did he compose at 5?
I don't know. Interesting. I just read a great book by Darren Freebury Jones, which sounds pompous.
Very pompous.
Yeah, it sounds pompous, but he's actually a very down-to-earth man. He's not pompous. He's merely British.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He can't help it.
He can't help it. He comes by it naturally, and he'll love this aspect of the conversation when I point it out to him. What Darren points out in his recent book that we talked about on the podcast is that a lot of early writers then and now copy. They copy extant texts. They copy schoolbook exercises. They copy Latin phrases, because back then Latin was taught in elementary school, in primary school. So we don't know much about Shakespeare's early years. Like, there's a missing period. We assume he went to London, and one of his first plays with Two Gentlemen of Verona, a romantic comedy. It's kind of problematic in places and not as funny as his later comedies became. But then he began to work on the Henry VI plays, which really sort of made his reputation, and writing an historical play was a popular form.
Why?
Because people liked seeing plays about famous people. I think it was celebrity driven, right?
So, I was going to ask you that. Also, yeah. Was there a satirical element to skewering celebrity?
I think there was, but he had to be careful in skewering the royalty, monarchs. Sure. So he wrote about kings who had been safely dead for hundreds of years, where he could still score political points, but within the safety over the safety net of writing about kings and or Roman the Caesars, mm-hmm. etc., people who had been dead for safely hundreds of years. But I do think he was satirical. I think the excessive levels of language in Love's Labour's Lost is a satire on other playwrights who use fancy language. It's a satire on pedantry. In fact, there is a Holofernes. There's a famous scholar character who's a satire on, we think, maybe one of a professor or a schoolmaster that he had in Stratford.
Like a blowhard kind of person.
A blowhard, pompous guy, yeah. And the levels of gore in Titus Andronicus are on such an extremely violent level that I have to think that was satirical as well. He's giving the audience what they want, but he's also giving them more.
So he's, you know, he's so revered, right? We're supposed to be so gentle and so, you know, take such care with Shakespeare. But really, it sounds like, even just in this short bit of information I'm learning, that Shakespeare didn't take things so seriously. Like, he was skewering and satirizing and maybe poking fun and laughing. I've often wondered if he would be an improviser today, like just full of a little rebellion, not wanting to, you know, improvisers. I'm really hawking improv right now, but in terms of someone who wants to make their own path.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I, th- I, th- I, I, the, historical record about Shakespeare suggests that he was an absolute man of the theater. He made his money by, he was a co-owner of the Globe Theater. He was a former actor. He wrote plays. He got props. If you've ever seen that documentary, Shakespeare in Love, it shows all of this.
And that's not a lot of assumption. Those are some facts we know.
Well, those are some facts we know, but some of that is suggested by the plays that he wrote.
Okay.
So, for instance, in Hamlet, this Danish prince, for some reason, has an extraordinary level of knowledge about how plays should be performed and how actors should say their lines.
Oh, fascinating.
So he's making, I think he's making satirical fun about the actors in his company. You know, when he had Richard Burbage, his leading star actor who played everything from Romeo to Lear and all the kings and great roles in between, he also played Benedick. And when he's and Benedick, Benedict has to sing a song and make fun about the fact that he's a terrible singer, which has got to be Shakespeare making fun of the actor that he's writing for. He was from a company of actors. He was in an ensemble.
Does this not thrill you at how some things never change?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I think here's another. I mean,
that is fascinating.
I mean, some of this is because we know so little about Shakespeare. I've always believed that Shakespeare becomes, you know, to, as Hamlet says, to the purpose of playing is to hold the mirror up to nature. And I think Shakespeare is the mirror we hold up to ourselves. And so we see ourselves in him. And so my sense is that if you were diving into Shakespeare now with this renewed energy and interest,
yes.
you would find a lot in your own background, as a woman of science and as an improviser.
Okay, thank you. This is really fascinating to me.
Hi, this is Ian Gomez, and you're listening to the Reduce Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? The spring tour of our updated version of All the Great Books Abridged begins this week with performances in Harrisonburg, Virginia and Louisville, Kentucky, then continues later this month and next in Elyria, Ohio, Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, and Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Check out the touring page at our website, reduceshakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with improviser Liz Allen, talking about the difficulties she's had connecting with Shakespeare.
This is rounding out what doesn't get taught as much, or maybe I didn't hear it so well. And my class about Shakespeare was in the 80s, and then another class I took was in the late 90s, and then that's it.
I think part of that is that frequently Shakespeare is taught as literature. And the plays were never written to be read as literature. They were always meant to be performed and spoken out loud, which is why it helps me, again, to say the lines out loud.
Absolutely.
You know, so if you're reading it as an assignment in class, almost anything you read as an assignment, you're going to have a chip on your shoulder when you're reading it. If you're coming to them on your own, I think there's a greater chance for exploration and genuine discovery.
Okay, so we were talking before we started recording about how I'm taking another writing class to always practice that skill. And I come too much from improv in terms of not capturing, you know, sometimes improv creates a weakness where you're not comfortable capturing things on paper. And what I'm learning so much in this class is the difference between spoken written word and read written word.
Yeah.
Night and day.
Yeah.
And so that's really interesting. It was sold to me as a literature class, absolutely,
yeah.
as opposed to a performance.
Yeah.
Do you think Shakespeare snacked when he wrote?
100%.
What do you think he snacked on?
Cakes and ale.
Okay, great. Do you think Shakespeare read to his family? You know that writer of Cold Mountain, Charles Fraser? He said every day he wrote, that night he'd read to his family. So they would hear his unfolding book every night. And their responses gave him a lot of information. Do you think Shakespeare ever read to his family or friends?
I suspect he didn't read to his family because he did most of his writing, we think, in London, and his family was in Stratford-upon-Avon. But I think he had actors to read his lines. And as an actor himself, my sense is he said these lines out loud in his writing chamber. you know, because he knew they were going to be spoken eventually.
What was Shakespeare's take on improvising during rehearsals or I'm just curious, is there any improv connection?
Hamlet directs the players to have your clowns speak no more than is set down for them. So
Bingo.
Right. Because he worked with clowns in his company who would frequently improvise. And he said, and in one of his plays, it's Taming of the Shrew, I think, he talks about, no, that line was extempore from my mother wit. Yeah, so he refers to improv a lot.
It is, again, interesting how little things change.
Yeah.
Across hundreds of years.
And in fact, Dee and I both love Taming of the Shrew, a famously problematic play, because, you know, every production you see or every way that play is taught is that Petruchio is assaulting Kate and treating her badly. And he says, well, it's the Kate, it is the sun. No, that is the moon. No, it is night. No, it is day. And
gaslighting?
Well, gaslighting, or Dee and I saw it and went, oh, they're improvising. They're learning how to play with each other. It's a play about a couple, a problematic couple, to be sure, who are learning how to be a couple and how to play and how to not negate what the other is saying.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Marriage is the same.
Yes.
Is there any play of Shakespeare's that you have found to be unreducible / any you don't want to reduce?
Well, yes. Well, no. I think they're all reducible. I mean, because reducible, the word reducible has so many definitions. We can reduce anything to like a sentence, you know. But are they worthy of staging in reduced forms? I think they are. I think many of them are. Are there some plays of his that I would rather not ever see again?
Okay, like what? Well, 100,
Merchant of Venice.
Okay.
Merchant of Venice, I think, is problematic in many ways.
And why don't you want to see it again? Like, I don't know it, so I have no idea.
It's hard. It's hard to do. It's hard to juggle the tones. It's supposedly, in air quotes, a comedy, one of Shakespeare's comedies. It's not very funny. Portia, the heroine, I don't think is that laudable. I think she's sort of a racist brat.
I'm going to open this book to a random page and see if a question pops up. This is a great pop-up.
Oh, that's funny. See whether a question pops up. I see what you did there.
Okay, so I see Henry IV and Henry V.
Okay.
Okay, so I have seen Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, Kenneth Branagh's Henry V.
And I do find that really compelling, but I think to myself, what a Herculean task to take that play and make it a permanent movie and make me able to somewhat follow it. I'm a little familiar with it. What's your take on that particular movie?
Well, I think it's a great film. It's a great, but his command of the language and all the actors' command of the language is exquisite. So even though you don't know the characters and really the warring factions, you're able to follow it because of not only how the actors speak the language, but how Branagh, the director, directs the scenes and stages the scenes. But you have your own experience putting improv on film because you coached the actors, the improvisers, in Mike Birbiglia's movie Don't Think Twice.
Correct, right.
And that movie is probably the greatest filmed record of an actual improv team working and performing. It doesn't feel fakey like a lot of improv on film does. So what Branagh did in a world he knows very well is only what you did in a world you know very well.
Okay, this parallel between me and Shakespeare is really going to make my pomposity at dinner parties go through the roof. I appreciate this. Well, what I find compelling about improv in real life is the real deep relationships that don't have an agenda.
Yeah.
To be funny or to be poignant or maudlin.
They're rooted in the connection between the characters on stage.
And that's a spontaneously discovered connection.
Yeah.
And what I like about Mike's approach to this movie about improv was that we agreed the same things that are compelling about improv, and then he just let that flourish.
Yeah.
And then when I coached the group, I coached to those moments, knowing those were the moments that would be captured. It was extremely fulfilling.
Yeah.
One thing I noticed in this pop-up book is there's these categories. There's tragedies, romances, histories, comedies. Had no idea.
Mm.
Okay? Because I'm a dope.
No, you're not a dope. You just haven't, this is not a thing you've been schooled in. It hasn't been part of your experience. They're arranged as histories, tragedies, and comedies because that's how all of his plays were first categorized in the first folio of 1623, which was the first collection of all of his plays in book form. Several of them had been published individually in smaller quarto forms, what we would call paperbacks today. The category of romance is a later designation meant for the later plays that don't necessarily conform to either comedies, tragedies, or histories. The romances are sort of tragedies, but with comedic happy endings.
And do they have some of the regrets in them that you said were written about later?
Yeah.
Okay, how many folios are there of Shakespeare's work?
There's at least three, and there might be four or five, but I know that there's at least three. The first one was 1623, and then they would produce different ones. But I know we have very few copies of the third folio, I think it is, because many of them were destroyed in the Great London Fire of 1666. But by that time, so many copies of the first and second folios were in private hands outside of London. Getting back to your point about Birbiglia's work on that film and improv generally, improv, like Shakespeare originally, was not created to be read. It was not created. It's only a thing that exists on stage. Now Shakespeare's plays exist in printed form, in book form.
Then that's very similar, because improv's not supposed to be captured.
Right. And it's very hard to capture.
It's very hard.
Which is why Birbiglia's movie and your achievements in that film are amazing and unique.
That's very sweet. I'll take a little bit of that credit. I really have to push a lot of that, if not all of it, off to Mike, that he wanted to be as genuinely, captures the genuineness of improv, if possible. And the irony being, improv it was taught to me that it doesn't get recorded. It doesn't get, all you do is retell it later at the bar, and then it lives forever in our hearts and never gets captured on paper. So that's an interesting, wow, I never in a million years would have thought there's any sort of parallel between, except for cake and ale, between me and Shakespeare.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. Liz Allen's Shakespearean journey continues, and maybe yours does too. Shakespeare's birthday is next week, April 23rd, and one way you can celebrate is by grabbing a copy of Pop-Up Shakespeare, written by me and Reed Martin and beautifully illustrated by Jenny Mazels. Then send us your favorite Shakespeare connections via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. Thanks as always to tour guide Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout out this week goes to Matt Hart Spade. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to my TV husband, Ian Gomez. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 958 2874ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
All right, so Liz Allen, where do we go from here on your journey? What do you think is the best thing for you to do next?
Well, I think I need to ask you, what should I see first? I think I should not read, and I have seen Henry V, but it's been a long time ago. Yeah. Where would you point someone who's mostly in, a complete moron, but has a little bit of a foothold of information? I worry this is boring to your listeners, because they know all of this. They've been through all this, but maybe they have suggestions. Like, what do you think? Where should I start? I got 2 hours to fill, let's say, next weekend. What should I watch to underscore what you've taught me.
The first thing you should do is obviously get yourself a copy of Pop-Up Shakespeare that you could refer to it all the time.
Well, here it is right here in front of me. How thoughtful of you. A Pop-Up Shakespeare. And this is not for kids. This is for everybody,
right? It's for everybody, including kids. Yes.
That's terrific.
Yeah. It's funny. There are so many. They're not so many, but there are many. There are many great Shakespeare films out there. The first one that comes to my mind is Richard II. Not a crowd pleaser by any stretch, and it's part of the Hollow Crown series.
Wait, why isn't it a crowd pleaser?
Because it's about a more obscure English king.
All right. Well, that's another hole in my knowledge. We got to get back together for English.
That's right.
I mean, you can say Plantagenet to me and I nod, but I don't really know what it means.
Well, I could say Tudor too, and I'm talking about cars.
Lights.
Lights. Good luck, Liz.
Thank you, Austin. This has been so illuminating. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome, and I hope it'll be illuminating for others who feel the same way. And I do. And if you come away at the end of your journey going, yeah, you know what, Shakespeare's still not for me, I respect that.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say. I can already tell just by what I've learned in our time together, I'm very intrigued. And I think I can say Shakespeare is for me. Now I just got to catch up.
This podcast is a production of the Reduce Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reduceshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.